You see things vacationing on a motorcycle in a way that is completely different from any other.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas.
In a car, you're always in a compartment, and because you're used to it, you don't realize that through that car window, everything you see is just more TV. You're a passive observer, and it's all moving by you boringly in a frame. On a cycle, the frame is gone.
40 years ago, a book with the improbable title Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was quietly published. The writer and the publisher hoped that it might sell a few thousand copies.
On a cycle, the frame is gone.
Instead, it went through dozens of printings in both hardcover and paperback in the first year alone, and it's never been out of print in the decades since. Some sources estimate it sold upwards of 5 million copies.
You're completely in contact with it all. You're in the scene, not just watching it anymore. That concrete whizzing by 5 inches below your foot is the real thing. Same stuff you walk on, it's right there. So blurred you can't focus on it. Yet you can put your foot down and touch it anytime. And the whole thing, the whole experience, is never removed from immediate consciousness.
Robert Persig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance has been described as the most widely read book of philosophy ever written. Just after it was published in 1974, Robert Persig granted what became something of a landmark interview to Ideas contributor Tim Wilson.
Why is the time right to you?
Right now? Yeah. Well, I think there's things tend to run their course, and I think
Tim turned the interview into a radio feature, and on this episode of Ideas, we'll revisit that original interview. You'll hear some fresh material from it that's never been heard before, not since then, and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance first appeared 4 decades ago. We're calling this program The Motorcycle Is Yourself. And Tim Wilson is with me in the studio. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Paul.
So we're going back way back here, 1974. You spent a whole day with Robert Persig. What was that like?
The better part of 2 days, actually. And remember in Reader's Digest, there used to be a column, there may still be, my most memorable meeting. Meeting Persig was easily one of the most memorable encounters, interviews of my entire life, career.
Wow, that's saying a lot because you've talked to a lot of people.
Well, I talked to famous people. And he wasn't famous at the time I met him, which I think was an important part of what happened.
What made it memorable then?
I remember feeling he was like Mr. Fix-It on TV. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? He's so friendly and familiar and avuncular. I walked in and I immediately felt like it was the guy next door or my father in his basement workshop. Wow. And here he was producing what's been regarded as one of the most towering books of philosophy and thought and important books of our time.
Which has one of the strangest titles as well. I mean, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Persig says right up front in the author's note, right at the top of the book, he says, what follows is based on actual occurrences. Although much has been changed for rhetorical purposes, it must be regarded in its essence as fact. However, it should no way be associated with that great body of factual information relating to orthodox Zen Buddhist practice. It's not very factual on motorcycles either. Well, he's honest, at least up front, but it's an odd title and it's an odd form of book. How do you describe it?
It's very difficult to describe because it's several books in one. It's a long narrative essay and a philosophical inquiry into the background of our notion of the good and value and how to live one's life. It's a very moving story of a father and a son on a motorcycle trip across America in the late 1960s. And it's a personal odyssey, a psychological story, if you like, of the author trying to find a ghost of his former self who had been committed to a mental institution and judged insane and submitted to electroshock treatment. So all those three things are, I think, brilliantly, and many agree, brilliantly interwoven into this book.
It's a serious book, and even the three things that you mentioned are three very, very serious ways of looking at the book.
Absolutely. In the 25th anniversary edition of the book. It's been for...
Which is 15 years ago now.
15 years ago, when the 25th anniversary edition came out, Persig, they published the correspondence between Persig and the publisher. And the query letter is a brilliant piece of query. It's a very short letter. And Persig said, "This book is about a unification of spiritual feeling and technological thought. Part of its thesis is that the division between these two is a deep root of the discontent of our age, and this book offers some solutions to it."
So that was the query. Was it successful? Did they buy it right away?
He sent it to 122 publishers. 122 publishers. Now, I thought there was one after the other. He told me that he made punch cards and had them all printed out on an electric typewriter.
Wow.
Sent them all. Six publishers responded, but only one picked it up and ran with it.
"We're traveling to Montana, maybe further than that. Plans are deliberately indefinite, more to travel than to arrive anywhere. We're just vacationing. Secondary roads are preferred. Paved roads in the county are the best. State highways are next. Freeways are the worst. We want to make good time, but for us now, this is measured with an emphasis on good rather than time. And when you make that shift in emphasis, the whole approach changes." "Now, what I would like to do is use the time that's coming up now to talk in depth about things that seem important. What is in mind is a sort of Chautauqua. That's the only name I can think of for it. Like the traveling tent show Chautauquas that used to move across America. An old-time series of popular talks intended to edify and entertain, improve the mind and bring culture and enlightenment to the ears and thoughts of the hearer."
How would I say? He's saying, "I'm going to tell you about morality and wisdom and enlightenment and the improvement of mankind." Now, you can't say that to somebody straight. I mean, they're going to say, "Well, aren't you being a little too much?" And so he says, with his humor, yes. But really, he means it, you see. He really wants to do this. And that's so rare in a book, that anyone would actually deliberately seek to talk. It's really audacious that he would jump on a motorcycle and like the Ancient Mariner, grab this reader and say, "Now here, I'm going to tell you about quality. I'm going to tell you about moral improvement in your life, about the more worthwhile things." It's almost as though its very boldness is what makes it succeed.
That last voice you heard was Robert Persig, the author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I've got a sense of his character. What about his past, the background, his biography?
Well, when I met him, he was in his late 40s. He was born in 1928. I was myself just in my late 20s. Persig had been a writer of computer technical manuals till just before he wrote this book.
Wow.
At $6 an hour was the rate that he was making for his computer technical manuals. But that's also a clue. I mean, he was doing a daytime job of writing technical manuals. He wrote manuals for the cosmetics industry before he wrote this. This was his first book.
Hmm.
His original field, he had studied biochemistry. So he had a background as a scientist, and then he moved into studies of rhetoric and philosophy. He traveled in India as a young man, and I think that was quite formative for him. He was at Banaras University and imbibed some important elements of Eastern philosophy there.
When you hear his voice there, it doesn't sound like a philosophy professor or a Zen monk. It sounds like somebody who might be working a farm in the Midwestern United States.
Exactly, exactly. Very, very accessible in a way. But, I want to say something, Paul, about the opportunity of revisiting this, because in the introduction to the 25th anniversary edition of the book, Persig said, "The highest quality thing I could do right now would not be to cruise on the successes of my book, but to correct some of its mistakes." Mm-hmm. And with this radio program, I want to try and do the same thing and add to the quality of it, because I don't think I really understood very much of what he was on about philosophically and metaphysically. I just didn't have the background, and the ideas were very complex. My daughter, who has just graduated from Oxford with her doctorate, listened to this program a couple of weeks ago, and she said, "Dad, it's impenetrable. I can't understand what he's saying. What is this about? And so I thought, okay, there's something wrong here.
Wow.
I think we have to lay out some definitions or approach it in a different way. I was trying to impress. I used, in the script that you heard a little bit of back there, I used phrases like, between the pincers of Aristotelian dialecticism or something. And I listened to it a while ago. I thought, what the heck does that mean?
We were so much older then. We're younger than it now, you know, I think. What in a nutshell is the book about, though? What is he trying to solve? What are the issues he's looking at?
It's very hard to put this in a nutshell, but the problem that Persig was trying to get at, I think, was that emotion and reason had always been regarded, are still regarded, as being separate, irreconcilable ways of perceiving the world. But he, in Persig's view, these two things are united or can be united. So he uses a dialogue with, he calls his previous self Phaedrus, after a character in one of Plato's dialogues. Plato, in his dialogue about Phaedrus, divided the human soul into reason and emotion. And in his dialogue, Plato gave primary place of reason over emotion. And that way of emphasizing dialectic and analysis and division of things into categories and was taken up by Aristotle and eventually developed into the dominant subject-object split that we've had in Western thought. So you have objectivity and reason and logic and dialectic on the one hand, and subjectivity and emotion and imagination and intuition and rhetoric on the other hand. And these things have never mixed or melded or been joined, been welded, to use Persig's term.
So what does motorcycle maintenance have to do with resolving these issues that have been in Western philosophy for centuries?
Because you can look at a motorcycle as an example of both of those ways of looking at the world. The motorcycle is a system of organizing tappets and pistons and all the parts into classifiable, almost infinitely sub-classifiable categories. And at the same time, you can look at the gleam of the thing and listen to the sound of it, especially the kind of Harleys that are famous for their sound, and make judgments, important judgments, about the functioning of the thing from a purely romantic perspective.
So it is a perfect image for what he's trying to do.
It's a brilliant image for what he's trying to do.
A motorcycle may be divided for purposes of classical rational analysis by means of its component assemblies, and by means of its functions. If divided by means of its component assemblies, its most basic division is into a power assembly and a running assembly. The power assembly may be divided into the engine and the power delivery system. The engine will be taken up first.
You are the mechanic, there is the motorcycle.
The
You're forever apart from one another.
Housing,
you do this to it, you do that to it. These will be the results.
System, an ignition system,
this eternally dualistic subject-object way of approaching the motorcycle sounds right to us because we're used to it. But it's not right. It's always been an artificial interpretation superimposed on reality. It's never been reality itself. All the motorcycle is a system of concepts worked out in steel. There's no part in it, no shape in it that is not out of someone's mind. I've noticed that people who have never worked with steel have trouble seeing this, that the motorcycle is primarily a mental phenomenon. They associate steel with given shapes, pipes, rods, girders, tools, parts, all of them fixed and inviolable, and think of it as primarily physical. But a person who does machining or foundry work or welding see steel as having no shape at all. Steel can be any shape you want if you're skilled enough. These shapes are all out of someone's mind. That's important to see. Steel? Hell, even the steel is out of someone's mind. There's no steel in nature. Anyone from the Bronze Age could have told you that. All nature has is a potential for steel. But what's potential?
To know what the components are for.
That's also in someone's mind.
According to functions is necessary.
Ghosts. That's really what Phaedrus was talking about when he said it's all in the mind. special. It sounds insane when you just jump up and say it without reference to anything specific like an engine. But when you tie it down to something specific and concrete, the insane sound tends to disappear. The facts are there, but you don't see them. You're looking right at them, but they don't have enough value. Quality, value, creates the subjects and objects of the world. The facts do not exist until value has created them. I just think that the flight from and hatred of technology is self-defeating. The Buddha, the Godhead, resides quite as comfortably in the circuits of a digital computer or the gears of a cycle transmission as he does at the top of a mountain or in the petals of a flower. Zen Buddhists talk about just sitting, a meditative practice in which the idea of a duality of self and object does not dominate one's consciousness.
What I'm talking about here in motorcycle maintenance is just fixing. When one isn't dominated by feelings of separateness from what he's working on, then one can be said to care about what he's doing. That is what caring really is, a feeling of identification with what one is doing. So the thing to do when working on a motorcycle, as in any other task, is to cultivate the peace of mind which doesn't separate oneself from one's surroundings. Peace of mind isn't at all superficial. It's the whole thing. That which produces it is good maintenance. That which disturbs it is poor maintenance. What we call workability of the machine is just an objectification of this peace of mind. The ultimate test is always your own serenity. When one has this feeling, then he also sees the inverse side of caring, quality itself.
And I think one of the messages of the book was that the good life is not to be found somewhere else, it's to be found in your daily life, you know, and this term is a term of your daily life you can't get rid of. There was a section there where Phaedrus subtracted quality from the facts of daily life, and it turned out to be an inhuman, impossible world. So I'm saying this element exists by virtue of the fact that you can't get rid of it, and that's an important test of truth. Some of the philosophers I'm dealing with will sometimes try to say, well, this quality is just a category of things. And I say, oh, no, it is not a category of things. It's a direct experience. Because if you try to subtract this direct experience from your life, you know, you find that it's really... your life is impossible to live.
40 years ago, Tim Wilson did a program for Ideas about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which is probably the best-selling book of philosophy ever written. We're revisiting that program today in a show we're calling The Motorcycle Is Yourself. Now, Tim, we just heard Persig talking about quality. A lot of the book is about quality. How would you define quality, or is even that the right thing to do?
That's such a trap of a question. I feel like answering you the way a Buddhist monk might. What's the sound of one hand clapping? Persig refuses for most of the book to be drawn into defining it, because defining it already is destroying it in a way. The closest he comes is an image of a knife edge. Quality exists at the knife edge of experience before you have language, before you can describe or name your perception. He calls it the first slice of undivided experience. So it's what people who do Zen might recognize as before thought, before
so
description.
So instinctive.
It precedes any kind of intellectual construction. We see a tree, and before we think, oh, that's a tree, or that's an elm tree, or that's an oak tree, as soon as we're able to put that description on it, it's already in the past, it's not there. And quality always exists in the present moment.
The fellow I was talking to about this was a chess player. In fact, he was chess champion of Minnesota at one time, and I played chess with him a lot. And he could not evidently see what I meant by quality, because he was such an extremely rational, analytic person. And then we went back over how we made chess moves. And I said, you know, I don't have any rational program for selecting the right move. I just look at the board and look at the board and work out various permutations. And all of a sudden, I go, oh. And then I grab the piece and move it. And I'm saying that moment of onus is what I mean by quality. there in the center of your most rational activity is a quality perception. And if you think about it, you see that that moment of onus is actually what guides the entire development of the chess game. It's what makes it interesting. It's what you really play for, I think, not to win, but to get that onus out of discovering really good moves, high-quality moves. So I think a problem in the future with this book, as this, what I'm hoping to do is develop the what I'm calling the dialectics or metaphysics of quality. The problem is going to be to expand intellectual awareness of this element that runs through intellectuality and guides intellectuality. I don't think I've got it across yet, at least judging from the reviews. That final realization of quality becomes, in a sense, an identification with the source of things. And although in our mythos, in the entire culture of the Western world of the 20th century, this has no importance. In the other half of the world, this is of primary importance. And I think not too many people understood that, in fact, very few people understood that what I meant by a direct perception of quality in its pure form was enlightenment, you see.
I think we got to pause for a minute here. He's not happy about defining quality. In fact, he sort of wants to run away from that definition. Does he define enlightenment?
Oh, that would be dangerous as well, to try and define enlightenment, because he even said, he remembered the Taoist saying, those who speak don't know, and those who know don't speak. You don't dare claim that you've discovered it or arrived there. But I mentioned earlier that he had been in the 1950s to India and studied at the university in Benares. And he came across a Sanskrit doctrine known as Tattvam Asi. It's a saying in Sanskrit that is actually fairly well known in the West, which means you are that, thou art that, which is a way of saying everything you think you are, which is subjective, and everything you think that you perceive, objective, are in fact one. There's no division there. And to realize this lack of division is to become enlightened.
So it's a comprehension of the unity of everything, then.
There's a feeling of landing on the center of things. I like the way he put it. You've arrived at the center of things.
I could also imagine, though, you could be feeling like you're going madly off in all directions at the same time, too. Like it could drive one crazy.
Well, it did. It did in his case, and it's no joke, because to have that perception can make one utterly, stonily silent. What more is there to say if and when you've arrived at that? And in Persig's own case, when he had arrived at what I think he would say was an enlightenment, he was staring at a wall in a corner at a friend's party, and people thought he was catatonic and might be dying, who knows. And at that point, they committed him to a mental institution. And so his enlightenment presented as insanity, and it was treated accordingly, drastically, with multiple electroshock treatments. It's such an important part of his life then and now. And the book is an attempt to revisit, to reconcile, to meet, to know that earlier self, and at the same time have to leave that behind, because it was dysfunctional. He wasn't functioning well in his family. Functioning is such a bloodless word. He wasn't relating to the rest of the world, and the rest of the world regarded his state, which he speaks of as enlightenment, as having gone nuts.
I think our current mythos may be on a verge of merging these two understandings, that at least some insanity is in fact a kind of religious experience which is devoid of its traditional Christian symbols or symbols of any sort. That meditation, for example, is not necessarily something someone does deliberately. It may be something that someone does because he can't help but do anything else. And so many people are classified as schizophrenic who just go in a room and sit by themselves and don't talk to anybody and refuse to say anything. Now, if they went and did that in a monastery, that would be a very high form of activity. But since they're doing it without any sanctions, oh, the poor fellow, we gotta really help him. Again, I refer to another part to the Greek oracles in the chapter in the book. How is it that those inventors of reason used to listen to the oak leaves as a source of wisdom? Well, I think perhaps many of our insane are listening to oak leaves at this time and acquiring kinds of knowledge that we are disregarding at our own loss. So the physical frontiers of the world have certainly been exhausted, but I think the psychic frontiers of the world are just now beginning to open up.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1, CBC.ca, and Sirius XM. My name's Paul Kennedy. We're calling this episode, The Motorcycle Is Yourself. The book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was published 40 years ago in 1974. We're revisiting the program that was broadcast back then about the book and its author, Robert Persig. Tim Wilson did the program for Ideas back then, and he's here with me now. Hi, Tim, again.
Hi, Paul.
Well, so the book was published in 74. It went through dozens, maybe more printings, even in the first year alone. Why was it so instantly popular?
Well, if you can remember back to the 70s or late 60s, you remember a huge cultural revolt, a cultural shift, I won't say a paradigm shift, but certainly huge shifts in the culture, where masses of people were leaving their factory jobs, their daytime jobs, and going to India, discovering themselves. It was a time of huge shift. People running from a culture that was full of conformity and boredom and burnout and consumerism. And at the same time, you had the New Age, you had new forms of spirituality, you had all kinds of esoteric literature that was freely available, the I Ching and the Tibetan Book of the Dead and all kinds of stuff. I think Doris Lessing said, have you ever stopped to think how amazing that is, that all of this perennial knowledge was suddenly poured into the culture all at once in a space of a short decade or so? So you had this huge conflict between these two kinds of cultures. And Persig saw belonging to the industrial culture, the daytime, boring daytime job, and at the same time having tasted something of the new spiritual frontier. He saw the people who were trying to escape, who were lifting off and ascending into higher consciousness in these new forms, were leaving behind a history and a legacy of classical thought and rational rigor that would be damaging if he left it behind. Two of the people who went along on the motorcycle trip with him and his son were good examples of that. He makes them into examples of that, though they weren't actually. But he uses them to say, if you don't care about understanding the system of your motorcycle, the intricate way these parts work, you're going to miss out important stuff and you're going to burn out in the middle of the desert and you may die because you didn't take the time to pay attention to the classical, rational ordering of things. So he was worried and wrote the book in response to this attempt to escape.
A lot of the stuff that was associated with the what we'll call a romantic movement of the 60s was just plain impractical, you know, like not fixing your motorcycle. Well, or that motorcycle, an Easy Rider, that had the gas tank the size of a football, you know. Yeah, well, and these fellows are it seemed to me as a motorcyclist that they're not going to get much farther than San Bernardino on that gas tank unless they keep refilling it every 25 miles, because a Harley is a notorious gas eater. And this tank was so small they couldn't have done cross country with it. But that's not a good example of what I mean by the impracticality of the 60s. When my wife and I were first married, we went out to Reno and became dealers in a gambling casino, and then saved $3,000 from that, went down to Mexico and started to build a sailboat. And I was going to write a book down there. We were leading the romantic life, and the romantic life by itself, as we led it at that time, seemed to get kind of thin. I don't know if you know that feeling. It just seemed like we were sort of detached and ethereal, and we weren't really meshing gears with our own lives. But eventually we ran out of money, which is far more serious than running out of ideals, and had to come back and get a job, and I got one at General Mills here in the research laboratories doing magazine articles and feeling very much, oh, what do you say, abused, or not abused, but feeling very depressed at having to get caught up with this horrible factory system. So I was very sympathetic to the rebellion of the 60s because I'd gone through a very similar rebellion at that time. I'd told my father, couldn't understand what it was that made me insist, that, or not insist, but just feel that, I had to get out of this country or go crazy. It was just the whole idea, this would be back in 1950, you see, the whole idea that one should become another Ronald Reagan, you know, and move up ahead not Ronald Reagan himself, but the roles which he played of the all-American good guy, you know, who lives the happy suburban life and so on, was just so expected of people that anyone who felt that that was inadequate was regarded as almost suspicious, or at least a person with deep personal problems. The fact that the problems might be the problems of the culture rather than the problems of the individual would never have dawned on anybody back in the 50s. Well, now it's quite apparent to everyone, I think, or at least most people, that the problem is a cultural problem rather than an individual problem. There are just too many individuals who are going through similar revolt. And so people are asking, what is the modification of the culture necessary to accommodate this huge departure of our best? Not our worst, but our best. And the question is now, not how do we attack the squares, but how do we take the best they have to offer and incorporate it with the new visions and newest things that we've seen. And at the same time, how do we fuse with their tradition in such a way as not to waste it, you see? Mm-hmm. And what's really nice, and I did this in this period of the 60s where I kept my hair short and worked in the factories and took orders and did all that, found that you can take a typical factory job and enjoy it. And my technical writing has certainly got to be considered one of the more boring of factory jobs, particularly computer technical writing. It's just an ocean of mathematical data that has to be assimilated and correlated. And yet I felt that as I applied the principle of quality to this and said, I'll do the best I can and enjoy it for its own sake, that this was successful and did in fact make for a good working day for me, you know. And I joined a professional society and worked for the upgrading of people there. But I said, it's no good for me to shout, you know, well, the government's got to do something, or the factory's got to do something, or somebody's got to do something, when it's so obviously available for me to do something through the increase of quality of my own work.
So, Tim, it's clear that quality can have the effect that he says it has there. If you really take care of your motorcycle, if you really take care of yourself, if you really concentrate on all the things that make things work, that will have an effect that will spill over into everything in your life. Where does Zen come from? The first word in the title of the book, Zen. What does Robert Persig take from Zen?
I think the main part of what Persig was saying that struck home with me was grounding everything, bringing all of these esoteric realizations right down into the most ordinary of middle-class lives. And nowhere was that as vivid as when we walked down into his workshop in the basement.
What was that like?
It was so familiar. My father had a workshop like that, not quite as many tools, but it was so familiar and was so physical and so direct and so immediate and so real.
So you found Zen in his workshop, really?
I would never claim to have found Zen anywhere. I'd be shocked.
Yeah, close to it or something.
What he showed in the workshop, and for many people that's their favorite part of the program, what he showed me in that workshop was quality come home to roost.
So it was the personification of quality, which is he refused to define a little earlier.
It was the embodiment. It was the crystallization. It was the direct. Oh, boy, already that's sounding pretentious, you see. It was just a bunch of tools on his bench in the basement. But what he said about them, What you'll hear him say about those things, I think, just brings it right home.
Things are pretty unchaotic at the moment. Usually they're a lot worse than this. But the idea here has been to get maximum versatility rather than maximum speed, to be able to do almost anything, and gradually growing up into more and more advanced and difficult things. I began to see that to fix things adequately, to fix a wide variety of things adequately in modern society, you've got to go away from woodworking into working with metals. So you notice a lot of the tools here, there are the customary woodworking tools here, but the main group of them are metalworking tools. And I can show you, let's see, some things I've welded. My first project here to teach me welding was the making of a drill press. A pretty ridiculous drill press, but it's all welded out of junk. And so I use the drill press and the welder and also this little lathe to make whatever tools I want. The lathe is quite a historic machine tool. I think in Scientific American, as a matter of fact, there was a very nice little essay on the lathe as a historic instrument of modern technology. I've sometimes said it exists halfway between Greek mathematics and modern automotive engineering. This is a machine which operates strictly in accordance with the principles of geometry. It creates conic surfaces. And when you get into the operation of a lathe, you begin to see that it's primarily a machine to maintain geometric relations and transfer those geometric relationships to steel. The reason so many of our automotive parts are bolts, screws, pins, pistons, cylinders is because these are the shapes that a lathe produces. Now here's a treasure trove of odds and ends. Here's a squeeze bulb for a battery and a gauge for checking spark plugs and a little light that you attach to your forehead when you really can't do anything else, and a little mechanic stethoscope here and a little set of... You can locate the source of noises with this very easily. When I was living in Mexico, the romantic life of the boat builder and the artist and the writer, I was actually very bored all that time, whereas... Now that I'm working in what's normally considered a very dull part of the United States and working at a factory job, I find that everything has just become very interesting. That boredom on the job actually is an incentive to creativity. I used to have a maxim that necessity may be the mother of invention, but boredom is sure the father. Because you really, when you're bored, it always precedes a period of great creativity. You can't stay bored forever. Sooner or later, something comes loose. Hemingway used to say, I turn my candle down and down and down and down and down until finally it explodes. And this is what I was talking about earlier when I say I deliberately enter a period of boredom just prior to writing, because I find that ultimately I land upon that center of things. And the sitting people, of course, do that same kind of boring thing. It ultimately brings me down to the center of things from which all creativity comes. That's that compartment. Over here in this drawer, you notice how this drawer rolls in and out? That's on roller skate wheels that I happen to have lying around from the kids' roller skates. And I found that when a drawer is full of metal like this, if you don't put it on some sort of heavy-duty rollers, you'll never be able to pull it out. Yet this thing, you can push it in with your little finger, as you can see, or pull it out with your little finger. And I've had that. That was one of the first things I put in, one of the first applications of my welder when I bought it. And I've just been very pleased. It seems like every time I open that drawer, I get a good feeling. It's a kind of quality returning home to roost time and time again. Make some marks. All right, first I'll turn on the main transformer here. The hum was caused by the 60-cycle current surging through the transformer, but that blowing sound is caused by a fan. And that fan dissipates the heat that's created by eddy currents within the steel of the transformers. In addition, you get a hiss of a spark that's jumping back and forth and creating a high-frequency pilot current.
Steel can be any shape you want, These shapes are all out of someone's mind. But when you tie it down to something specific and concrete, the insane sound tends to disappear. Phaedrus was dead. Destroyed by order of the court, enforced by the transmission of high-voltage alternating current through the lobes of his brain. Approximately 800 mils of amperage at durations of 0.5 to 1.5 seconds had been applied on 28 consecutive occasions in a process known technologically as annihilation ECS. A whole personality had been liquidated without a trace in a technologically faultless act that has defined our relationship ever since. I have never met him, never will.
Oh, the electrotherapy, yeah. Yeah, it's a terrifying experience. As I vaguely remember it, and maybe remember it inaccurately, there's a drug which is given you to prevent your spine from snapping when the shock hits. And this drug, which is similar to a derivative of curare, the South American poison that's used to paralyze animals, will stop your breathing. And sometimes your breathing will stop before you lose consciousness, so you'll sit there unable to breathe. And it is very much like drowning. You're just sitting there unable to breathe, dying from lack of oxygen, and then grateful when finally unconsciousness reaches. And I would think it's like being keel-hauled on a ship. You remember when they used to tie a person to a rope and run him under the ship and let him drown under the ship and then bring him back up and out and revive him. And to have this happen over and over and over again, and then not quite remember it each time. So each time the memory of what's happened to you is destroyed, then only at the next moment, it seems, when they're about to do it again, you remember, oh my God, I've been through this already. They're gonna stop my breathing and I won't be able to breathe. And then I remember in the middle of the agony of not being able to breathe or just struggling, all of a sudden my vision would go sideways. And then there was that blessed release of unconsciousness from this nightmare happening. If this had been a truly therapeutic thing, one could justify that and say, well, we're saving this person from a fate worse than death, so to speak. But I don't know that the knowledge of the people who are administering the shock treatment is so omnipotent that they can properly make that decision. I think the decision should ultimately be participated in by the patient himself. They can say, well, the patient is incompetent mentally, he can't make this decision, we have to make it for him. But that kind of paternalism is a denial of the humanity of the patient. And when your own humanity is denied, then you're very lucky if you can come back and forgive those people who've done that. So I would really say that should not be done. It's a real crime, and I hope it won't continue. We never know, you know. And I suppose that's why I feel these are my people, because I've seen so many of them who are pleading the same case. I say, don't try to correct me, just understand me, will you? And they're so hard to understand, you see, that people say, well, we don't have time, you know, and what you say really isn't very important. And what we say is important. We know what's good. And this is the old act of the Inquisition, saying, we know, don't tell us, we know, you heretics. See? Now, I just, again, proceeding in terms of my own internal lights, I could be completely wrong in what I'm saying. And I hope I never forget that I might just be, you know, off on a tack of my own that's completely wrong. But so might they, see. And I remember an old statement of Oliver Cromwell, a deep Christian, I said, when he used to say to others, I beseech ye in the bowels of Christ to believe ye, bethink ye that ye may be wrong. And this is what I would say to the psychiatrist today. Please don't forget that you might be wrong, you know. I don't ask you to believe that you're wrong, but believe that you might. And it's a very deep thing with me. And
There's only one kind of person, Features said, who accepts or rejects the mythos in which he lives. And the definition of that person, when he has rejected the mythos, is insane. To go outside the mythos is to become insane. Insanity is the terra incognita surrounding the mythos. And he knew. He knew the quality he talked about lay outside the mythos. The mythos. The mythos is insane. That's what he believed. The mythos that says the forms of this world are real, but the quality of this world is unreal, that is insane. And in Aristotle and the ancient Greeks, he believed he had found the villains who had so shaped the mythos as to cause us to accept this insanity as reality. That now, that ties it all together.
My own feeling in the hospital is that what we call sanity is a very thin tightrope, which some people just get sick of walking. See? And they'll go off into other areas. And in those areas, they may discover things that are very valuable to those who prefer to remain on the tightrope. And that those people shouldn't shut themselves out from these infinite possibilities of human thought that exist apart from the mythos, away from the mythos. Normally, one who's within the mythos says, here I am believing in reality, and everything that contradicts this is just scary never-never land. I don't want to have anything to do with it. But one who's been outside of this world and who's been in these other areas, they say, there you are in your own narrow little perspective, and you think that's important. God, what you don't know, you know. But you can't tell, you see, because that person is afraid to hear these things. And so someone who tries to tell them these things gets very cautious. And he says, I'll tell you a little bit. And please listen. You know, please have the decency to listen to someone outside your own sphere, and in that way improve the condition of all people.
Well, you can hear in the emotion in his voice there just how much he had been through.
Yeah.
At that time.
It's a brutal honesty almost.
It's a brutal honesty. He really exposed himself, and when you consider what had been done to him when he showed, and he was on a knife edge at that moment. Mm. He had been committed to a mental institution. He was obviously still conscious in the present day, even though he was, in a sense, cured, that it was not forever behind him. Mm. And that he could hear it, smell it, in the next room, in a way. So there's a huge generosity in showing that, and I want to acknowledge that. It was part of what endeared him to me. I think I should also add that Persig, though he sounds there as if he's demonizing the doctors for having put him through that, he was very, very careful to say afterwards, I'm not wanting to blame them. The important thing is to understand the difference in values, their value and the cultural value, and my own sense of value. So he's really quite insistent about not being judgmental. Be perceptive, but don't be judgmental.
Do we know how he's doing now?
He's still alive. He lives in New England, and he's in his late 80s now. He has remarried. His son, who we haven't talked about in this program but is a major part of the book, his son was tragically killed in a random robbery outside the Zen Center in San Francisco. So he lost one of his two sons.
Wow.
He wrote a follow-up book. He spoke in our interview often of wanting to take Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and turn it from just what he saw, just a touching personal story, into a well-elaborated system of metaphysical thought. And he produced a follow-up book called Lila, which is the story of a journey he made down the Hudson River in a sailboat. And in that book, he tried to set out or to elaborate his thinking about the metaphysics of quality, but it didn't receive anything like the critical acclaim or the attention that the earlier book had. There is, however, a website called moq.org, metaphysicsofquality.org, which in the last at least 20 years has carried on very eruditely the discussions about quality that he began in the book.
So it's 40 years later. You visited him in the Midwest on a cold day or 2 days. You got a lot of tape from him. Is there anything that still really, any one thing that really resonates from that time?
He said a number of times during the interview, "I had to follow my own lights." I was trying to impress him. I was trying to show off a bit by quoting Thomas Szasz, the psychiatrist. I quoted R.D. Lang. I quoted Doris Lessing. I quoted all of whom I'd read the book jackets of and not read the full books of. Really, no, I have to acknowledge that because it speaks to how little I think I understood of his huge argument. But he kept saying, "I had to follow my own lights." And that's what I carry away from it, was that at the risk of the torture that he went through and being ridiculed or being ignored, he wasn't ignored, at great risk, he decided to say what he felt needed to be said. And he did it in his own way. And I found a bit of tape that it was not in the program, but when I was listening to the original 4 hours just a few days ago, where we were talking about the writing itself and how he would put things, how he would express things.
I should mention that another thing that critics have not noticed is that the principles in the book were applied in its actual preparation. In each case, there was a quality decision made, and by adhering to the idea of seeing quality directly and then going with that quality decision, I was able to be very original in this book. And that's, of course, one of its extreme characteristics, is that it just doesn't sound like anything that's ever been written before. And the reason for that is that in each case I said, well, that sounds better to me that way than the other way, and I don't need any further justification. And so in this case, there's the book is an application of the principles it preaches.
Tim, what's the personal impact that Persig and the book have had on you?
There was a moment after we'd had dinner, after we'd sat for a couple of hours talking, and we'd had some wine, not a great deal, where I felt overcome in somewhat the way I was just a few moments ago, and I articulated quietly to myself, I couldn't be luckier than being right here. There couldn't be any higher quality than what I'm being part of right now. And I think in a way that's what he's talking about. When you're joined so completely with the person you're with or the moment you're in or the job that you're doing, that is the creation of quality in one's life.
If you had a chance to see Robert Persig today or tomorrow, what would you say to him?
I'd say thank you. Big time.
Tim Wilson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Tim Wilson did the original ideas feature about Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance. Diane Dacola and James Hurdle did the readings. David Cherniak participated in the interview with Robert Persig in 1974. The program was produced for Ideas by Claudia Buckley and engineered by James Reed. The Motorcycle Is Yourself was produced by Dave Riddell. You can find out about upcoming Ideas episodes by signing up for our weekly online newsletter at our website, cbc.ca/ideas. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Greg Kelly is the executive producer, and I'm Paul Kennedy. The Hourly News is next.